for be the James still around after the first one is killed in Acts 12, 15, and 21. Although Acts has so egregiously toyed with the chronology, contradicting the first-hand accounts of Paul in almost every particular, that we might guess that Luke has accidentally transposed a story actually about James the Pillar to a later period, forgetting that he had killed him off earlier. After all, Luke does not otherwise explain why this second James is suddenly and consistently treated as the leader of the church in Jerusalem, which James the Pillar is known to have been. Later Christian legend, first attested only late in the second century, a whole lifetime or two after Acts was written, replaced this James ben Alphaeus with James the brother of the Lord. But Luke clearly has no knowledge of this connection, nor, we must conclude, did any sources he may have had. Nor do any of the other Gospels show any awareness that any brothers of Jesus ever had a role in the church at all, much less as a leader. Mark had already suggested none of Jesus' family entered the church, as he has Jesus essentially disown them. So after the first chapter of Acts, the moment Christianity's history becomes public record, it suddenly appears as if Jesus had no family whatever. That is certainly more likely if there was no Jesus in the first place. For if Jesus didn't exist, then our author's genuine historical sources, insofar as he had any, would only have begun with the origin of the church under Peter, as represented from Acts 2 on, and these sources would never mention any of the family of Jesus, or Pontius Pilate, or anyone who buried Jesus or carried his cross, because no such people existed. Or else they had nothing to do with a historical Jesus. Minimal historicity, by contrast, cannot as easily explain this. One might shoot from the hip and argue that Luke had some motive for erasing the family of Jesus from the history of the church, but that is refuted by the fact that he didn't. He includes them in the original congregation in Acts 1 verse 14. It is also rendered intrinsically improbable by the fact that if later legend were true, and James the brother of Jesus was a major leader and key figure in the early church, erasing him from the history of the early church should have been impossible. Any Christian aware of the legends would want to know how Luke could erase so important a figure from his account and still be trusted as a historian. It also has no plausible motive. If Luke wanted to downplay the role of Jesus' family in favor of Peter and Paul, for example, he would far sooner invent accounts of them explicitly doing so. He would not simply forget they existed. Just compare how Luke rewrote the entire history of Paul's interaction with Peter and the Jerusalem church in Galatians 1 and 2. That's what he does with historical facts he doesn't like. He doesn't just delete people. He makes them say and do the things he wants, indeed needs. I must conclude that the history of the early church as recounted in Acts looks very much unlike what we would expect on minimal historicity. Contortions are required to get what we have to fit, such as assuming ad hoc that in fact Jesus had no family, or that strange motives were available to erase them from history completely. Motives that would not sooner motivate a rewrite of what they said and did or what happened to them. Even the point about there being no missing body, the narrative simply makes no sense on the supposition that there was one, but makes perfect sense on the supposition that there wasn't, which agrees with there being no Jesus to bury. And the disappearance of Pilate, as if he would be wholly unconcerned that a man he executed was reported to have escaped, are all exactly what we expect on minimal mythicism, but not exactly what we expect on minimal historicity. But there at least we can retreat to combining minimal historicity with an early resurrection doctrine that did not require a missing body, though I think that is much less ad hoc, since a strong, independent case can be made that that is probably in fact what the original Christian resurrection doctrine was, it is still not 100% guaranteed. Or we can retreat to supposing Acts is almost complete fiction, and thus all of its strange omissions are just the result of Luke being an insufficiently imaginative writer. On that theory, having inherited no material about the early church, other than perhaps the letters of Paul, Luke had no knowledge of Jesus' family, and so didn't think to include them in his tale. Likewise, everything else that makes no historical sense. This entails a dilemma. One must either reject Acts entirely as evidence, being so wholly fabricated that it cannot be trusted as reliably attesting to anything, or one must accept that its omissions are improbable on minimal historicity, but exactly to be expected on minimal myth. This does not mean impossible, just improbable. So we must assign some probability less than 100%. This is true even if Luke is wholly fabricating, since even then it is not 100% likely he would forget these things. Those omissions are unlikely even in fiction, requiring an explanation, which requires a supposition not in evidence, which lowers the probability of any explanation we muster. My most generous estimate would be a 4-in-5 chance, roughly an 80% chance, that Luke would write Acts 2 through 28 as we have it, if he used or was aware of any kind of genuine sources for the early history of Christianity. Which is the same as saying there is only a 20% chance he would have included material about the brothers of Jesus or any of the other missing people in his life, and thus an 80% chance he wouldn't. Yet I think an 80% chance Luke would completely omit Jesus' family from the whole public history of the church, as well as other things we should otherwise expect to be there, is being absurdly generous. My more realistic estimate of this probability would be 2-in-5, or about a 40% chance he'd leave all this stuff out, hence a 60% chance that he would have said something about these missing people and events. If, however, Luke neither used nor knew any real sources or stories, but just made it all up, or adapted sources that did, and given that he himself was clearly a historicist, or certainly was selling that dogma with these books, whatever he personally may have believed, then there is no longer any logical connection between these bizarre omissions and any actual absences in the history of the church. But even then, those omissions would not have one-to-one odds, as if they were equally mysterious on historicity or non-historicity, because they would still be at least a little weird, requiring a supposition, not in evidence, that Luke was not a sufficiently imaginative writer to realize what he was leaving out. I think it's improbable that Luke had no lore to work from, no information about the earliest missions or the family of Jesus. Regardless of whether he used any of it or not, it's surely more likely that at least a basic outline of what happened was known to him. I think there had to be, by his time, tales about the role and fate of Jesus' family, especially Mary and James or even Jude, if such people existed. And likewise, what happened in Jerusalem the first time it was announced that an executed convict had risen from the dead. So was Luke writing in total ignorance or from a starting point of at least some knowledge? I'll assume the latter. I'll discuss what to do if you disagree in section 7. Note also that anyone who attempts to bypass this estimate by claiming Jesus had no brothers or none ever connected with the church must also agree that Paul could never have referred to brothers of Jesus holding prominent positions in the church in that case, which means you then cannot cite his doing so as evidence for historicity. As long as you can accept that consequence, then you can change the estimate here from 2-in-3 to 1-in-1, since the non-mention of non-existent brothers is always 100% likely, and thus would be so on historicity as well as non-historicity. But you must also accept a reduction in the prior probability, because then you are assuming something not commonly the case, that a man in antiquity had no siblings. Even that his parents would disappear from history, although more probable, is still a bit odd for someone who is being worshipped as God's emissary. Section 4. The Trial Transcripts of Paul. Another curious thing about Acts is that when the trials of Paul are examined, rather than his sermons elsewhere or the speeches of others, the historical Jesus himself mysteriously disappears. Surely this is at least somewhat less likely on historicity than on non-historicity, since on the latter hypothesis, we can expect that in any actual trials Paul was in, only a cosmic revealed Jesus was attacked, defended, and debated, and that appears to be what Acts reports to have happened. Whereas on the former hypothesis, many issues and facts pertaining to the actual deeds and sayings and fate of the historical Jesus would come up as pertinent or even essential. Again, what we make of this strange omission depends on whether the author of Acts is making it all up, in ignorance of what actually happened, or whether he is adapting, reworking, or rewriting some earlier source that portrayed what happened at those trials. That source need not be historical. It could itself be a complete fabrication, perhaps itself an earlier Acts of Paul, telling tall tales of how he stood up to the authorities in legal contexts and won, but still written by people more in the know, whether the actors themselves or those who knew them, and thus building on assumptions held at the time about what would occur in such trials or what would make sense to them given what the first Christians such as Paul actually believed. For example, if this proposed source text were written by a companion of Paul who had no conception of a historical Jesus recently executed by Pontius Pilate, because that exoteric myth hadn't been invented yet, then even his made-up accounts of the trials would reflect that. One argument for this being the case is the remarkable disparity between these trial accounts and speeches and sermons that take place elsewhere. If Luke were simply fabricating the whole thing, these accounts should be consistent. The actors would say the same things when asked to pronounce and defend the gospel, regardless of where they were. But strangely, they are not. Everywhere else, the speeches and sermons in Acts are conspicuously historicist. But when Paul is on trial, where in fact historicist details are even more relevant and would even more certainly come up, they are suddenly completely absent. That is very strange, which means very improbable. The best explanation of this oddity is that Paul's trial accounts were not wholesale Lucan fabrications, but came from a different source than the speeches and sermons Luke added in elsewhere, a source that did not know about a historical Jesus. In Acts, Paul faces two trials, one brief encounter in Greece and an extended period of hearings in Judea. The first occurs before Gallio, then the Roman governor of Greece, on a charge of, quote, persuading men to worship God contrary to the law, end quote, Acts 18, verse 13. But Gallio dismisses the case. His bench decision reads, quote, if there were any wrongdoing or violent crime here, then it would be reasonable to pay attention to you. But if this concerns questions about words and names and your own laws, then see to that matter yourselves. I'm not interested in being a judge of these matters, end quote. This is all too vague to be of any help, since nothing about Jesus even comes up. It's the next series of hearings in Judea that are more conspicuous. This is the story of it as told in Acts. After Paul inadvertently causes a riot throughout the whole of Jerusalem in Acts 21, verses 17 to 31, the Roman garrison commander Claudius Lysias intervenes, Acts 21, verses 31 to 39, and calms things down and lets Paul give a public speech essentially summarizing his story up to that point in Acts 21, verse 39 to Acts 22, verse 21, which for some unexplained reason outrages the crowd and they start rioting again, calling for his death in Acts 22, verses 22 to 23, at which Lysias takes him back into custody and retreats to interrogate him to find out what is going on when he discovers Paul is a Roman citizen in Acts 22, verses 24 to 30. A detail Paul himself never mentions in his letters. In fact, in 2 Corinthians 11, verse 25, he says he was caned three times, which contradicts Luke's depiction of Paul as touting his citizenship to avoid a beating. In Paul's speech to the people during this episode, he makes no mention of a historical Jesus, only a Lord known by revelation, in Acts 22, verses 6 to 15 and 17 to 18. Indeed, Paul has another revelatory encounter with Jesus shortly after that, in Acts 23, verse 11. Lysias then brings Paul to a meeting of the Jewish elite to find out why the riot occurred. At this inquest, the Pharisees present concluded, quote, we find nothing wrong in this man. Maybe a spirit spoke to him, or an angel, end quote, Acts 23, verse 9. But then they get into a fight with their Sadducee peers over religious differences, and a riot breaks out again. So Lysias takes Paul out of there in Acts 23, verse 10. Lysias then learns a small army of Jews was forming a plot to assassinate Paul on his next day in court, at which he immediately ships Paul off to the Roman governor under massive guard, nearly 100 horsemen and 200 infantry, Acts 23, verses 12 to 24. To explain this extraordinary action, Lysias wrote an official letter to the governor explaining the disposition of Paul's case, and that letter reads as follows, quote, Claudius Lysias to Felix, the most excellent governor, greetings. This man was seized by the Jews, and they were about to kill him. And so I set out with an army and took him out of there, having learned he is a Roman. Since I wanted to know what they accused him of, I brought him into their court, where I found he was accused regarding questions of their law, but there was nothing in the charge worthy of death or prison. When a secret plot against the man was revealed to me, I sent him to you at once and ordered his accusers to charge him before you. Farewell. End quote. Acts 23, verses 26 to 30. This cannot be an authentic document as presented, since it lacks features a real one would necessarily have, such as Paul's full Roman name, and indeed the full names of Claudius and Felix, and the date, for example. But whether a fabrication or a literary abbreviation of a real letter, it still conspicuously lacks any mention of a historical Jesus. Yet the fact that Paul was advocating the worship of an executed convict would certainly have been pertinent information for Lysias to mention to Felix. The more so, if that convict was believed escaped and still at large and giving orders to his co-conspirators. Even just the fact that Paul's case was connected to the execution of an accused insurrectionist and pretender to the throne could not fail to be essential information here, considering that Paul was advocating the worship of that pretender to the throne, which would surely put Paul under suspicion of being an insurrectionist or a traitor himself. Instead, the letter says his case only had to do with obscure matters of Jewish religion and involved no violation of Roman law. Paul is then brought under that massive guard to Felix, Acts 23, verses 31 to 35. His accusers are then brought in and allowed to plead their case in Acts 24, verses 1 to 9. They accuse him of fomenting insurrection and defiling the temple, neither of which, of course, Paul was guilty of, nor did they have any evidence to back up those charges. Yet again, no mention is made of his worshipping a convicted felon who was executed on suspicion of declaring himself king. Yet surely, in reality, his accusers would have made a great deal of hay out of that. Paul is then allowed to respond in Acts 24, verses 10 to 21. He also makes no mention of Jesus, only that they have no evidence to convict him on, and that he is only really being accused because he agrees with the Pharisees that there will be a resurrection of the dead. Felix ends the inquiry, makes no judgment, and keeps Paul locked up for 2 years, for no explicable reason, and somewhat against the law protecting the rights of Roman citizens. During this illegal imprisonment, Felix has Paul over for dinner on occasion, where Paul scares him with talk about future apocalyptic judgment, in Acts 24, verses 22 to 27, but still never a word about a historical Jesus. Even though he tells them all about, quote-unquote, the faith in Jesus Christ, Acts 24, verse 24, we're not told what that means. A new governor moves in, named Festus, and the Jews try to get him to ship Paul back to Jerusalem, but instead he holds an inquiry, Acts 24, verse 27 to Acts 25, verse 12, at which nothing changes. The same vague charges are advanced, which Paul simply denies, except that Paul appeals to be sent before Caesar, and his request is granted. While Paul awaits departure, Festus is joined by King Herod Agrippa, and they bring Paul in to discuss his case for some unexplained reason, Acts 25, verse 13 to Acts 27, verse 1. And Paul is eventually shipped off to Rome. It is here that we finally hear more details about the case. Festus tells Agrippa that Paul's accusers, quote, brought no charges of crimes, as I suspected, but only certain questions against him having to do with their religion, and concerning a certain Jesus who was dead, whom Paul affirmed to be alive, end quote. Acts 25, verses 18 to 19. Which means he didn't even know who this Jesus person was. An impossibility if he had been executed by Pontius Pilate some years before, as surely Festus would have learned by now. Indeed, it looks like the dispute over whether Jesus was dead or alive is only understood here to be an obscure question of Jewish theology. At this point, Paul finally gets to say his piece, providing us with a lengthy speech spanning 22 verses, Acts 26, verses 1 to 23, yet at no point does he ever refer to a historical Jesus. We hear only of a cosmic, revelatory Jesus. No mention is made of Jesus having a ministry, or having appointed disciples, or of having been executed on charges false or true, or having proved himself divine by miracles or teachings or anything at all. This is very much unlike Paul's speech to the synagogue in Antioch in Acts 13, verses 23 to 41, which goes into explicit details of the gospel account of who Jesus was and what happened to him. But here, in his trial speech of comparable length, Jesus is known only through a, quote-unquote, heavenly vision, Acts 26, verses 13 to 19. The only mention Paul makes of the death and resurrection of Jesus is to say that, quote, Moses and the prophets said it was going to happen, end quote. Not that anyone had actually seen it happen, nor that there was any real evidence it did, much less that Pontius Pilate played a role in it and Roman records would confirm it, Acts 26, verses 22 to 23. In fact, the only source Paul cites for it is Scripture. Paul preached only what, quote, the prophets and Moses said would happen, whether the Christ would suffer, whether from a resurrection of the dead he would be the first to proclaim light to God's people and to the Gentiles, end quote. Acts 26, verse 23. Revelations and Scripture, his only sources, his only offered evidence. It thus makes sense why Festus would answer, quote, you've gone mad, Paul. Your abundant learning has driven you mad. Acts 26, verse 24. Since the only thing Paul says he was accused of preaching is what he learned from Scripture and from voices in the sky, the only rebuttal Festus could offer is that Paul had gone off his rocker. Paul assures him he hasn't, and says to Agrippa that, as a Jew, quote, he knows about these things, end quote, because none of the facts Paul relates, quote, are hidden from him, since this has not been done in a corner, end quote. Acts 26, verse 26. What things does Paul mean? That Paul has long been a devoted Pharisee, Acts 26, verse 4 and 5. That he was being accused of merely hoping for the fulfillment of Scripture, Acts 26, verse 6. Even though all Jews share that same hope, Acts 26, verse 7, which is the hope that God would raise the dead, Acts 26, verse 8. That Paul persecuted Christians, Acts 26, 9 to 11, but then saw a blinding celestial vision from God, Acts 26, 12 to 18. And he obeyed this vision and preached its message, which was simply, quote, to repent and turn to God and do works worthy of repentance, end quote, which he preached all over, and eventually to the Gentiles, Acts 26, verses 19 to 20, and that the Jews seized Paul for preaching this message, Acts 26, verse 21, and now he's on trial, quote, saying nothing but what both the prophets and Moses said was going to happen, end quote, Acts 26, verse 22. Not a single reference to a historical Jesus. Every single fact here could be true without there having been a historical Jesus, as the Pharisees had already said of Paul at the first court inquest starting this whole series of hearings, quote, maybe a spirit spoke to him or an angel, end quote. Indeed, in this whole account, from Acts 23 to Acts 26, that's all Paul appears to know about. Even as fiction, the historical deeds and fate of Jesus would be crucial rhetorical material for both the prosecution and defense in all of Paul's trials. They should have been arguing over the facts of Jesus' ministry, teachings, miracles, the facts of his death and the fate of his body, the charges against him and the significance of his conviction, and whether he was still alive and at large, and what he was instructing his spiritual soldiers to do. That Luke wouldn't even think of this when inventing these narratives is hard to explain, especially since when he provides us with speeches elsewhere, not just from Peter but even from Paul, as in his Antioch synagogue speech, he gives us something of what we expect. Whereas here, all of those details have mysteriously vanished. Despite this being collectively the longest and most detailed series of trial hearings related in Acts, I have to conclude it's at least somewhat more likely that Luke is reworking some narrative he received, a lost Acts of Paul, in which there was no Jesus executed by Pilate, but a cosmically dying and rising Christ known only through revelation and Scripture. Still, this does not leave me with a strong certainty. Possibly Luke wholly fabricated Paul's trials like everything else, and it just by coincidence didn't occur to him to put the same things in them that he did in most other speeches in Acts, even Paul's. Or maybe those things were in his sources for these episodes, and he cut them for space, not realizing the coincidental effect his decision would produce, and so on. Whether any of those scenarios is plausible or probable, I don't know. But I can imagine enough of them to say I would not rest an argument on this strange elision of the historical Jesus from the trials of Paul. I will say the probability of it, if historicity is true, is at best 9 in 10, which means I'll allow a 90% probability that Luke would write the Pauline trial accounts in the way he did, even if Jesus existed. Or at worst, 1 in 2, for a 50% probability he would do this. If, of course, he was using sources, and thus these elisions can reflect omissions in those sources. If not, then the odds might be nearer 1 in 1, because, again, that would be almost as mysterious a thing to do on either historicity or myth. Section 5. Stephen's Trial Speech. I've already noted Burton Mack's observation that the sermons used to persuade Jews to become Christians all throughout Acts are simply not believable history. In general, We know the standard practice in antiquity, even for the soberest of historians, was to fabricate the speeches of historical actors, based on what the historian was sure they must have said, as I noted in Element 44. They were rarely likely to have sources for the content of speeches anyway, and even when they had them, they were rarely likely to use them, if they didn't agree with the story the author wanted to tell. And we can often tell this is what happened. Consider, for example, the longest speech in all of Acts, that of Stephen, delivered to the Sanhedrin immediately before he is executed by stoning, Acts 6, verse 9 to Acts 8, verse 2. In the presence of Paul, and with his approval, then called Saul, in Acts 7, verse 58 and Acts 8, verse 1. There are historical inaccuracies in this account as we have it. Mishnah law required that a capital sentence be voted on the day after the trial, so the judges could think on it before taking a life, whereas Acts has the court stone him instantly, without even a vote. But that could be explained as a truncation of what really happened, or as part of the original fiction Luke may have been using as his source. Similarly, Stephen's speech draws on the Septuagint, a popular Greek translation of the Old Testament, perhaps an odd thing to do for a supposed native of Palestine in a Jerusalem courtroom, where summarizing the Hebrew original would be more expected. And he does this, though, complete with errors only present in the Septuagint, but that could be a reflection, again, of either its author's method of composing the fiction or Stephen's. Those elements don't concern us that much, but the overall content does. Stephen's speech is also unique in Acts in many other respects. For its content, its construction, its length, and its being assigned to an otherwise insignificant speaker. Stephen is only suddenly and inexplicably introduced in Acts 6 verse 5 so as to immediately become the first Christian executed for the faith. A strange course of events, given that Peter and John were twice tried for the exact same crimes and repeatedly acquitted, suggesting a huge narrative inconsistency that might again reflect Luke's employment of different sources, one treating the story of Paul, another Peter and John, or else his remarkable ineptitude as an author. Stephen himself is likely a fictional creation, a stock character representing a generic martyr. His name, Stephanos, meaning crown, evokes the standard epithet for a faithful Christian and martyr. Revelation 2 verse 10 encourages all Christians, quote, "Be faithful unto death, and I will give thee the crown of life, Stephanos tes zdois," end quote. And James 1 verse 12 says, "All who remain faithful in the face of temptation will," quote, "receive the crown of life, Stephanos tes zdois," end quote. Also, 1 Peter 5 verse 4 says that when Jesus appears to the faithful, quote, "You shall receive the crown of glory, Stephanos tes doxis," that never fades away, end quote. And 2 Timothy 4 verse 8 says martyrs, quote, "who love the appearing of Jesus," end quote, will receive, quote, "the crown of righteousness," end quote, Stephanos tes dikaiosunes, end quote. And notably, Jesus appears to Stephen immediately before he dies for the faith. Hebrews 2 verses 7 to 8 likewise says Jesus was, quote, "crowned with glory and honor," end quote, for his martyrdom. And the death of Stephen is indeed modeled on the death of Jesus. Like Jesus, Stephen forgives his killers just before his death. Compare Acts 7 verse 60 with Luke 23 verse 34. And just before they die, both Stephen and Jesus declare aloud that they give up their spirit to God. Just compare Acts 7 verse 59 with Luke 23 verse 46. Both deliver their last words, quote-unquote, "with a great cry," phone megale, the exact same words in Greek. Just compare Acts 7 verse 60 with Luke 23 verse 46. Both have their garments taken and given away. Compare Acts 7 verse 58 with Luke 23 verse 24. And just as Jesus says in his trial that his accusers will see, quote, "the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the power of God," end quote, Luke 22 verse 69, Stephen says in his trial that he indeed sees, quote, "the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of God," end quote, Acts 7 verses 55 to 56. Yet his accusers don't, presumably because it is not yet the apocalypse. Luke has also borrowed elements from Mark. Like Jesus, Stephen is accused by false witnesses that his enemies drum up against him, adapting Mark 14 verses 55 to 59 to construct Acts 6 verses 11 to 14. And the false accusations are also the same. Stephen is accused of claiming that this Jesus the Nazarene was going to destroy the temple and change the laws, the same thing Jesus was charged with in Mark. Notably, even though we know Luke used Mark as a source in constructing his gospel, he omitted both of these details in his account of the arrest and trial of Jesus. He uses them, instead, only here. Yet we know he knew of them, so we can be certain Luke made a conscious choice to use those details, originally said of Jesus, in the account of Stephen instead, which is a clear sign of fabricating the story. There is also a curious parallel between the unnamed young man, Neoniskos, who has his garment torn away and flees naked at Jesus' rest, Mark 14, verses 51 to 52, and the named young man, Neanias, Saul, that is, Paul, who is given the garments of Stephen's accusers, Acts 7, verse 58. So when Luke inserts into Stephen's speech a brief reference to the historicity of Jesus, the Jews betrayed and murdered Jesus just like their fathers murdered the prophets who foretold his coming, Acts 7, verses 52 to 53, this could obviously be Luke importing his own narrative assumptions, particularly as he does not have Stephen provide any further detail, nor have the Sanhedrin argue the point with him. Or it could have been a charge of mere cosmic responsibility, since Stephen in fact says, quote, "Now you have become his betrayers and murderers because you received the law as an ordinance from angels and you did not keep it," end quote, implying it was their disobedience that compelled Christ's death and not their actually killing him. Either way, Luke just assumes there would be no argument, which is historically implausible, and no reason for Stephen to be any more specific, even though he has Stephen speak over 1,200 words, consuming 5 pages of Greek, needlessly summarizing, at tedious length, the whole biblical history of the Jews. Surely the miracles, ministry, trial, and fate of Jesus were far more important facts to mention in his defense, in Acts 7, verses 2 to 53. As thus an evident fiction constructed by Luke, Stephen's speech is of no use in supporting historicity. Section 6. The Possibility of Aramaic Sources. This is also why we cannot make any headway arguing that Luke had source material for the speeches in Acts, because a greater preponderance of so-called Semitisms are found in them than in the narrative sections, which is to say, idioms, grammar, and vocabulary more distinctive of the Greek spoken by Hellenized Jews, like Luke himself may have been, or translated from Hebrew or Aramaic. On the one hand, this information is of little use, since it cannot be determined which is occurring. Are the Semitisms just how Luke writes in his own dialect, or do they reflect his use of a source? Nor does either make the historicity of the speeches any more likely, since fictional speeches can be composed just as easily in Aramaic as in Greek. And even supposing these Semitisms indicate the use of a source, we cannot determine whether that source was in Aramaic, for example, or was simply an original composition by another author in a Semitized Greek, which could again be just as fictional. On the other hand, Semitisms can also be an effect of a greater reliance on the Septuagint, a text already written in a highly Semitized Greek. For example, when composing speeches, where more extensive and more frequent allusions to and quotations of scripture are expected, even if the speeches are entirely composed by the same author writing the narrative sections. For example, the very first speech in Acts, in which Peter implausibly persuades thousands of Jews to become Christians in a single day, Acts 2, verse 41, is sometimes offered as a good example of the concept of being in a more Semitized Greek than the surrounding narrative, and yet in it Peter quotes not the Hebrew Bible or an Aramaic Targum, but the Greek Septuagint, verbatim. The most crucial part of his speech turns on his interpretation of Psalm 16, verses 9 to 10, in Acts 2, verses 26 to 31. But instead of quoting the Hebrew original, he gives a verbatim quote of the Septuagint. Psalms 16, verse 10 is word for word identical between Acts and the Septuagint, and Psalms 16, verse 9 is also identical in every word, with only a few insignificant changes of order. In reality, Peter would hardly attempt to persuade Jews in Jerusalem by haranguing them in Greek, much less succeed at it, and he certainly wouldn't have persuaded many of them by appealing to a Greek translation of the Bible rather than the original Hebrew text. No, this is Luke's construction of the speech. Luke is using the Septuagint to build the quotes in Peter's argument. That destroys any hope of recovering what Peter might have originally said, even if Luke somehow had some source for it. Finally, as D.F. Payne says, quote, Luke's indebtedness to the Septuagint was profound, but it was by no means his only influence. Other Old Testament textual traditions were known to him. Semitic idioms common in the contemporary church also affected his diction, and there is no good reason to doubt that he had access to traditions or documents couched in or translated from a Semitic language. However, such Semitic elements in Luke's writing must not be pressed to support conclusions which they will not bear. Hedley Sparks emphasizes, after analysis of his specimen passages, that Lucanisms surround the Semitisms. Mac Wilcox, too, on the basis of his more full analysis, asserts that his survey shows that in almost every case the material in which they, the hardcore Semitisms, are embedded has a strongly Lucan stamp. End quote. In other words, even where Semitisms appear in greater abundance, those sections also show unmistakable evidence of distinctly Lucan style, which means Luke has completely reworked any sources he may have used, deleting, changing, and adding to them as he pleased. We therefore cannot know what any sources he may have used actually said. For all we know, Luke may have taken a mythicist speech collection, such as I just argued for Paul's trial speeches, and added historicist flourishes to it. Since we have abundantly demonstrated that Acts was literarily crafted and much of its content freely invented by Luke, and Luke was certainly interested in promoting historicity, Acts' reliability for demonstrating the historicity of Jesus is essentially non-existent. Section 7. Weighing the Evidence. Luke's wanton fabrications, including his use of Josephus to make his story seem more historically informed, and his complete rewrite of history to reverse the facts reported directly by Paul, and his overt attempts to make his books look like histories, for example, adding such embellishments as Luke 1 verses 1 to 4, Luke 2 verses 1 to 2, and 3 verses 1 to 2, pretty much establish that he is not honestly reporting the facts as he knows them. He is trying to create facts and sell them as the truth. This makes it impossible for us to know if Luke was a historicist himself or merely trying to sell a historicist creed. But either way, we cannot use Acts as evidence for historicity, for anything in it will have been designed to convince us of historicity, with no assurance of any real basis in fact, and abundant reason to doubt there is any. But a text specifically fabricated to convince us of historicity, such as this, can give us evidence of myth if material in it doesn't make sense otherwise. The evidence in that case has slipped through, against what Luke obviously would have wanted, but due most likely to his not being able to think of everything, as most authors don't. After all, as the ubiquity of implausible novels and film scripts today well enough attests, even the smartest of people don't consistently compose realistic narratives or realize the holes in the plots they've contrived. If Acts is a wholesale fabrication, however, written in total ignorance of what may have actually happened, then Acts might afford no evidence for either historicity or myth. Its historical value either way could then be simply nil. So its effect on the probability of historicity depends on whether we conclude Acts was composed in total ignorance of what may have actually happened, or with some awareness of what actually happened during the first years and decades of Christianity, and thus has been at least partly influenced by that information. As I argued after discussing the trial transcripts and the vanishing Acts, I think it's unlikely the author of Acts had no information. His having some better explains the oddities I document. I will therefore assume he did. That the probability of this approaches 100%, close enough not to have to consider the alternative mathematically. But you may have a different view, believing it more likely that Acts was written in total ignorance, in which case you have a harder mathematical task ahead of you. Setting that aside, tabulating my previous estimates so you can substitute your own, we get the following ratios between the consequent probability that Acts would look like it does if minimal historicity is true, and the consequent probability that Acts would look like it does if minimal historicity is false. For the vanishing family and so on, best case 4 to 5, worst case 2 to 5. Omissions in Paul's trials, best case 9 to 10, worst case 1 to 2. The remainder of Acts, 100% expected either way. Conversely, nothing in Acts is unexpected on minimal mythicism, as on that account anything historicizing in it is a mythical invention of Luke's, and we've proved Luke was doing that a lot. While the omissions and vanishing acts would be the inevitable result of there being no historical Jesus. So the same consequent probabilities on non-historicity can be treated as all 100% across the board. And even if not, if instead we set this probability at less than 100%, it doesn't matter since the ratio of the two probabilities will remain the same. That leaves the probability of Acts looking this way on historicity equal to 72% at best and 20% at worst. The content of Acts is therefore evidence against the historicity of Jesus. Chapter 10. The Evidence of the Gospels. Section 1. How to Invent a Gospel. Among the many texts recovered from the 4th century stash of codices recovered from Nag Hammadi, Egypt, are two in particular, Eugnostos the Blessed and the Wisdom of Jesus Christ. The peculiar thing about these two texts is that they pull away the curtain and reveal a key pathway by which Jesus' tradition was invented. Eugnostos is a fake epistle, written by what is almost certainly a fake person. Eugnostos means well-knowing, an obviously fictional name. Possibly composed before Christianity, as it contains no material distinctive of Christianity, but appears to outline an esoteric doctrine of Jewish theology concerning the firstborn celestial Son of God, called the Savior and Son of Man. Note again elements 39 to 41 in our earlier chapter. The Wisdom of Jesus Christ then takes direct quotations from this epistle and puts them on the lips of Jesus, and expands on them to fabricate a post-resurrection narrative scene with dialogue between Jesus and his disciples. So here we see whole sayings of Jesus being invented by fabricating a historical conversation, a gospel-style narrative, borrowing things said by Eugnostos, and representing them as things said by Jesus in conversations with his disciples. This could be how much of the canonical gospels were composed, things said by other people in other texts being lifted and adapted and placed on the lips of Jesus. Certainly, these two texts prove this was being done, and we have no a priori reason to believe this isn't how it was always done. We've already seen examples of the sayings of Jesus being lifted directly from the scriptures in 1 Clement in chapter 8. And knowing that the scriptures included more books and variants than we have, as I noted in element 9, this raises the possibility that sayings of Jesus were lifted from lost scriptures too. Sayings were also invented for Jesus from previous Christian writings. Of course, sayings for Jesus and situations for him to say them in could also have been simply invented by each gospel author as he required, or by the author of whatever now lost gospel they were redacting. This is how entire collections of sayings were invented for Daniel and Moses, so why not also for Jesus? Indeed, the Mishnah, apart from lines attributed to subsequent rabbis, was supposed to be the accumulated teachings of Moses passed down orally, the so-called Oral Torah. But surely it is really just an accumulated collection of what other men said, not Moses. Attributing it all to Moses was simply a way of bestowing authority. Deuteronomy is likewise holy fiction, yet begins very similarly to the Gospel of Mark. Quote, "These are the words Moses spoke unto all Israel beyond the Jordan in the wilderness," end quote. We also know sayings for Jesus came from revelations, which could then have been placed on the lips of Jesus in a fabricated historical setting, as if said by a historical man, rather than, as originally, an imagined spirit of Jesus communicating to an entranced apostle, whether hallucinating or pretending to be, as noted in elements 15 and 16. If historical settings could be invented to make Jesus say what Eugnostos said, certainly historical settings could be invented to make Jesus say what he was believed to have said in Revelations, such as to Paul or any other apostle, or was claimed to have said in Revelations, as for example in the book of Revelation. We'll see in the next chapter that Revelation and Scripture appear to be the only source Paul knew for the sayings of Jesus. He shows no knowledge of them existing in any kind of historical narrative, except in one instance, the inauguration of the Eucharist, and that, he explicitly says, came to him by revelation. Note again element 16. We will talk about this more in the next chapter. Inventing historical narratives in which to place or adapt sayings was commonplace in ancient biography, even in general, but especially in faith literature. Remember again, Element 44. That was actually the norm. So the question is, are the Gospels fictional constructs, like the wisdom of Jesus Christ and Plutarch's Life of Romulus? In other words, are they just myths? Or are they some kind of historical records we can rely on to prove Jesus existed? Section 2. What is myth? There has been frequent debate over the genre of the Gospels and whether they are fundamentally myth or history. But myth is not really a literary genre in the standard sense, since it crosses all genres of literary composition. Plutarch's biography of Romulus is entirely myth, for example, yet written in the genre of historical biography. We noted this in Chapter 4 and in Element 47. Most attempts at identifying the genre of the Gospels consist of comparing it to other literary forms, but this has only resulted in either unresolved disagreement or classifying the Gospels as a unique genre of their own, which unhelpfully eliminates the opportunity to interpret them or assess their historical value by comparison with documents of similar genre. Even classifying the Gospels as biographies is unhelpful, as demonstrated by the example again of Plutarch's Life of Romulus. Even if the Gospels perfectly corresponded with the genre of ancient historical biography, that in itself would not indicate whether they were in fact historical or mythical. For in fact, a great deal of ancient biography, even of real people, was constructed of myth and fiction. Accordingly, our aim should not be identifying the genre of the Gospels, but the intent of their authors. Whatever literary form they chose or created, were they writing myth or history? There are countless definitions of myth employed in a variety of fields, and debate persists as to what exactly myth is, but such debates need not be resolved here. If someone claims the Gospels are myth, they can define myth any way they please, so long as they demonstrate the Gospels conform to that definition and then remain consistent with that definition when drawing conclusions. The major trend in the study of myth today is reflected and well surveyed by Radcliffe Edmonds in his own summary of myth scholarship and its main conclusions. In that school of thought, myth consists of factually untrue stories that are historically improbable but symbolically meaningful. Myths, in that sense, operate according to three basic rules. 1. A mythic story is a seemingly straightforward account of something that happened, yet its content and structure are carefully arranged to convey a deeper meaning than the superficial narrative might suggest. 2. This is accomplished using symbols familiar to the audience, keywords, ironies, allusions, double entendres, etc., relying on a known database of cultural, literary, religious, grammatical, and other facts. And 3. What an author of a myth changes is often the point of the myth. For example, if the story is highly allusive to another myth, yet reverses or radically alters certain elements of that myth, the allusions indicate what myth to compare the changes to, and the changes indicate how the author's message is meant to differ from the message of the earlier myth. In the words of Radcliffe Edmonds, quote, "Not only can an exploration of the various ways in which authors use a common set of elements uncover the different agendas of these authors and provide a deeper understanding of the individual texts, but it can also shed light on the ways in which myth was used as a device for communication, a mode of speaking in which they could convey meaning densely through the manipulation of mythic motifs and patterns that each had its own resonance for the audience." End quote. Very often this communicated message involved plans for reforming society, or proposing and defending models for how society or the world should function or do function. To this end, myths communicate the values and universal truths embraced by the author, which the author desires his audience to embrace in turn. As Edmonds puts it, quote, "The Greek poetic and mythic tradition provides the models of and models for the society, models which are given authoritative status as a description of the way the cosmos is constituted and of the proper modes of behavior within it. And their elements are symbols that enunciate a model with a general application. However, each myth, each telling of a traditional tale, presents a different variation of the model, as the teller shapes the narrative according to his perceptions of the cultural models. So, the symbolic elements within the tradition are manipulated by the teller. And this symbolic system, provides a language by which the myth teller may communicate with his audience. And as a result, every myth is shaped by its context and the motivations of its narrator. End quote. If the Gospels are myth in this sense, then we have a ready explanation for the considerable contradictions and changes in the Jesus story across the four canonical Gospels and other Gospels beyond, to which modern apologists respond with increasingly implausible ad hoc harmonizations, while historians respond with attempts to develop criteria to isolate the historical truth behind the conflicting accounts, a method that has consistently been found invalid. But if the Gospels are myth, then both efforts are futile, as both assume the intent of the authors is to record, if perhaps embellish, a collection of historical facts reported to them. If instead the intent of the authors is to construct symbolic myths about Jesus, then we have no reason to expect any of their content to be historical. Some of it may be, but since distinguishing fact from fiction would not have been of primary interest to the Gospel's authors, we will have little hope of finding clues to such distinctions in the texts themselves. We can work with external corroboratory evidence to isolate the factual elements, an ideal example being the archaeological and literary confirmation of the existence of Pontius Pilate. So, confirming the Gospels are myth would not in itself entail, for example, the conclusion that Jesus did not exist. But it would greatly alter and limit our ability to know the historical truth about Jesus, and would fundamentally change our focus in studying the content of the Gospels from an interest in extracting history from that content to an interest in ascertaining its mytho-symbolic meaning and intent. I'll have more to say about this in Chapter 12. This is often easier to see outside the field of biblical studies, where blinding bias runs rampant. In the Iliad, for example, Homer depicts a boxing match between two young men named Epeius and Euryalus. Epeius boasts of being undefeatable, in typical Homeric fashion, and then overwhelmingly defeats his opponent. Centuries later, in the Aeneid, Virgil mimicked this boxing match. But Virgil replaces Epeius and Euryalus with the Roman heroes Dares and Entellus, and changes its geographical location, its historical date, and even its outcome. Nevertheless, there are enough intentional similarities to confirm that updating Homer's tale was Virgil's intent, and the changes Virgil made, apart from the trivia of when, where, and who, become more meaningful when this emulation is recognized. In Virgil's account, instead of the boxers being two young men, Entellus is an old man who laments his lost youth. Then, the Homeric plot is reversed. Young Dares, the powerful braggart, does not win as his counterpart does in Homer. Instead, the old man, Entellus, although taking a fall just like his Homeric counterpart Euryalus, returns with a fury and overwhelmingly defeats his foe, who is described the same way Homer had described the defeated Euryalus, carried by his comrades and spitting out blood. Unlike the Homeric story, in Virgil's account, Entellus was driven to return to the fight by a sense of shame and valor, which were moral values emphasized in Roman culture. Virgil's story also reverses the Homeric glorification of youth and denigration of the elderly, again to reflect the more modern values of Virgil's time. The parallels break down like this. From Homer, the invincible youth Epeius becomes, in Virgil, the invincible youth Dares, both of whom boast of their great prowess. They each fight their opponent. From Homer, this is the youth Euryalus, who loses. In Virgil, he becomes the elder Entellus, who wins. Even though in both stories they take a fall. So we have numerous deliberate parallels and a couple of key and significant reversals. Thus, Virgil has told the same story as Homer, but he has recast the characters into a different historical setting and changed the plot in order to reflect and communicate how Roman values differ from Homeric values. This was a common practice. How you changed a myth was a way of communicating how your message differed from the earlier myth. Thus, when we find parallels in a later myth with an earlier myth, the way those two myths differ from each other is often the author's reason for borrowing from the earlier myth in the first place. What the new author leaves out, what he adds, what he changes, is all the point of the story, and is what we need to look at in order to understand what the author is saying. Virgil was certainly not saying that Homer got the historical context wrong, that the boxing match really took place at a different time and place between different people. Nor was Virgil saying that Homer incorrectly reported the historical outcome of the boxing match. It's doubtful either Homer or Virgil believed this boxing match actually happened, even though they both place the match in history and record it in a straightforward narrative that looks no different from any poetic record of witness testimony. Instead, Virgil is retelling this event in order to symbolically communicate his different values. What matters to him is not whether this boxing match occurred. What matters to him are the underlying values and message the story conveys. We thus don't gain any understanding if we try to harmonize these contradictory tales or to ascertain what actual historical event inspired them, even if any did. We gain understanding only by recognizing the parallels and changes intended by Virgil, and the significance of the resulting symbolism of the story's structure and content. Virgil's Aeneid is full of such transvaluations of Homer, rewriting Homeric narratives with Roman characters and values. For example, as Dennis MacDonald notes, quote, Virgil imitated the death of Hector in Homer's Iliad when composing his account of the death of Turnus, end quote. What the story means is all we can study, and all we should study, not whether it actually happened. Only rarely are we able to do more. It is therefore crucially important to determine whether the Gospels are myth. This cannot be achieved by identifying their genre, because myth exists in all genres. It can be achieved only by confirming whether they contain narratives that conform more to the definition of myth than of history. Are the central narratives of the Gospels historically improbable but symbolically meaningful? Is this meaning concealed by a superficially historical narrative that is highly allusive to other myths, texts, or concepts that increase both the interpretability and likelihood of the content of that narrative more than a supposition of history would? And is this evident in both parallels to and the conspicuous deviations from those targets of allusion? In short, is the content of those narratives more likely on the theory that they are myth or on the theory that they are history? Characteristics of myth are 1. Strong and meaningful emulation of prior myths or even of real events. 2. The presence of historical improbabilities, which are not limited to miracles, but can include natural events that are very improbable, like amazing coincidences or unrealistic behavior. And 3. The absence of external corroboration of key rather than peripheral elements, because a myth can incorporate real people and places, but the central character or event will still be fictional. No one of these criteria is sufficient to identify a narrative as mythical, but the presence of all three is conclusive, and the presence of one or two can also be sufficient when sufficiently telling. We must avoid parallelomania, of course, the error of finding patterns everywhere by relaxing what counts as a parallel, or finding parallels that have no identifiable reason to be present. Avoiding that requires focusing only on features that, altogether, are very improbable on any other explanation. Thus, chance correlations can be distinguished from genuine signatures of mythosymbolic composition. This does mean we might have to set aside correlations that might be mythosymbolic but cannot be proven to be. But that does not mean concluding they are not mythosymbolic, only that we cannot be certain that they are. Meanwhile, in many cases, we can be reasonably certain. And if we find enough of those in a single text, this supports the conclusion that the remainder are as well, according to the principle of contamination, which Stephen Law has formally articulated for miracle content in the April 2011 issue of Faith and Philosophy. His argument can be fully extended to all improbabilities, including emulative features of a story that are improbable coincidences if posited as history, but not improbable as an authorial creation. In Bayesian terms and with respect to the Gospels, what we are looking for in each pericope, each internally complete narrative unit within a Gospel, are features that are improbable as history but probable as myth. More precisely, that means features that have a lower consequent probability on history than they have on myth. Not in respect to Jesus being a myth, but just in respect to the pericope itself being a myth. If we start with no assumptions and thus assign a prior probability of 0.5 or 50% for history in this sense, and thus also 0.5 or 50% for myth, in other words, we are assuming both are equally probable at the outset, and then if we count the whole content of a pericope as E, or evidence, and treat H as history and not H as myth, and then we find that the probability of E given H is less than the probability of E given not H, the result will be that the probability of H given E will be less than 0.5, in other words, less than 50%. And that means the prior, the probability of H, that we use to determine the next pericope will be less than 0.5. If we find that the probability of E given H is less than the probability of E given not H for that pericope too, then the probability of H falls even further, and so on. If for any pericope, the probability of E given H equals the